Hello, and welcome to this installment of the Locus Roundtable podcast. Today, as part of our continuing series on poetry, we'll be talking to Rose Lemberg, who is the editor of Stone Telling magazine, and also a published poet and author of her own right. Rose, if you could say hi.
Hi, everyone.
Hello. And we'll also be talking with Emily Jang, who is an up-and-coming young writer who's recently been published in Strange Horizons, and also is going to have music being performed of her own composition soon. So, Emily, welcome.
Hi.
As I've been learning more about the poetry scene by putting together this series, it seems like there's just been an explosion of new writers and new venues over the last few years. Have you guys, and you guys seem to be absolutely part of that movement, have you observed the same thing?
Emily, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's that speculative poetry is undergoing a renaissance right now. There are more and more poets being published in more and more venues. There are more magazines now that are devoted entirely to poetry. We have Mythic Delirium, which was founded 10 years ago by Mike Allen. We have Goblin Fruit, which was founded in 2006 by Amal El-Mahar and Jessica Wick. And we have Stone Telling, that was founded in 2010 by Rose Lemberg and is now co-edited by Rose and Shweta Narayan. So I think that there are just more venues for poets to send their stuff and have it be, you know, being read by the general public, which is awesome. In addition, I think that in terms of the fiction magazines that are also starting to publish more awesome poetry as they're changing of the guards in their editorial staff. For example, Strange Horizons. I've been very, very impressed with what they've been doing for the past couple of years, ever since Sonia, Aaron, and Drew took over. I think they've been doing some really amazing stuff. And Apex Magazine is another favorite one of mine because of the influence of Kat Valenti and now Lynn Thomas. I think their aesthetics are perfectly in line with mine as well. But there's also some really other great magazines like Bull Spec, Not One of Us, Jabberwocky, and most recently I've learned about the Cascadia Subduction Zone. They actually did a whole issue focused on poetry, which was really cool, in April.
And Emily had some great ones. I published quite a few reviews with them as well.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of shocked because they're normally known as a review magazine, but they're open to lots of things, which I think is wonderful. I think that's kind of where speculative poetry is going. It's just really diversifying and giving mm-hmm. voices to a wide range of mm-hmm. Of perspectives, which is really great. And I think a lot also due to Stone Telling, because Rose has really worked really hard. Rose, you want to talk a little bit more about Stone Telling?
I want to talk about the mythic movement, if I can, for a moment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the mythic movement is what's really been exciting in speculative poetry and emerging, I think, over the last 10 years, maybe even more, with now defunct Journal of Mythic Arts, which was edited by Terry Wendling and Midori Snyder. And they have been incredibly inspirational to people, including Amal El-Mohtar and Jessica Wick, who and Mike Allen. And Mike, of course, was publishing Mythic Delirium, which was not, strictly speaking, a mythic venue. It was publishing all kinds of things. But with emergence of Goblin Fruit on the scene in 2006, as far as I understand it, then Mike also started to be, his aesthetic started to change, and he published two mythic anthologies in which he published some pretty incredible poetry by Kat Valenti and some other people. I am a newcomer. I came to speculative poetry in 2008. In fact, I sent out my first ever submission. It was a poem. I sent it to Starline, and it got an acceptance from Marge Simon within 3 days, which was very exciting. A poem about dragons.
I love it.
And since then, I realized that I could send poetry off, and I'm not a native English speaker, so it's been quite a surprise for me to discover that I can actually send out things in English. And I've been
so beautifully, Rose.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, I've started having things accepted. And at that time, Journal of Mythic Arts closed its doors, and there was also another venue that I really liked. It was called Lone Star Stories. And I just felt that something was missing from the genre, that those two venues closed, and there just didn't seem as much place, space for voices that were marginalized or maybe had something quite painful or quite difficult to say, or were trying something innovative. We're trying something innovative or daring that other magazines weren't really willing to take a chance on, or perhaps wasn't as accessible. So Stonetelling was an answer to that. And when I started to publish it in 2010, I didn't envision it as a mythic venue, and it is not a mythic only venue, but I think it feeds on this mythic aesthetic and takes it a few steps further into the great wide open of all genres, including an occasional non-speculative poem that, or slipstream, or however you want to call it.
Could you talk a little bit about what the mythic movement is as you see it? That's not a term I'm familiar with.
Well, the mythic movement is mostly poets working with mythic traditions from around the world, reworking them, giving those myths new spins. Often, this would be associated with feminist spins. Yeah. So, an example of a mythic poet is Sonia Taaffe, who
Absolutely.
Has been. Right, who has been producing just extremely influential and just beautiful work, working with all kinds of traditions. Recently, she's published a chapbook, which is just beautiful. It's called the Maisebichel, which is Yiddish for a little storybook. And it's full of poetry, mythic poetry, on riffing of Jewish themes, Jewish folkloric themes, which is just delightful. Sonia has been publishing since 2001, and she's been a part of Not One of Us. She's been published in Not One of Us frequently, and she's had some hand at editing, if I'm not mistaken, and she's been published in Mythic Delirium throughout those years. So she's been very influential, but she's not the only one. So other people who are doing mythic-inspired work include, of course, Kat Valente and Amal, who won the Riesling with some of her work, Claire Cooney, who also won the Riesling with some mythic work. There are some very interesting poets who are emerging right now, who are just terrific. Some examples of people I personally love to read, well, Shveta Narayan, I think, is an incredible poet. She's also a very close friend of mine and my co-editor, so obviously I'm biased, right? And I am too.
Shweta is definitely doing just groundbreaking stuff with her poetry. Absolutely, the way that she breaks lines and the fire that goes with her poems, the forms that her poems take, I think, are very fascinating as well. So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're not interrupting. Some other people that I really, really like that have been working with this tradition are J.T. Stewart. I don't know if you know about her. She's published she's published some pretty incredible genre work in speculative in literary venues, and she's one of the co-founders of Clarion West. She's a woman of African American descent, and she's just incredible. And I'm hoping to bring more and more of her work to kind of my readers. Cherie Renee Thomas, who edited Dark Matter, a century of speculative fiction from the African diaspora, I think it was called. She's also a poet, and she published some pretty incredible African folklore-inspired mythic poetry in the mythic anthologies that I've mentioned. Some of them I'm reprinting in my feminist speculative fiction, speculative poetry anthology, The Moment of Change, which is coming out from Aqueduct in less than a month.
Yay!
Congratulations. Yeah, it's going to be pretty amazing. Nancy Shang is someone I've really enjoyed. Sophia Samatar is incredible. She has just emerged, and she is writing poem after poem after poem. But back to mythic movement. Mythic movement at its core, as I understand it, looks at myths and folklore from around the world and was inspired by it for poetry. It is not a women-only movement, but a lot of very strong female poets who have emerged in the last 10 years have been a part of the mythic movement. And of course, this is not an official name of it. It's just something that we call it.
I would like to add Delia Sherman.
Yes,
she's, you know, very established already. I just adore her poetry as well as her fiction. And of course, Catherine Valenti is a must read for me always. And Theodora Goss.
Yes.
Her prose and her poetry are just stunningly gorgeous and lyrical. And it's just really, you know, I'm slightly new to the genre. I've only been reading the contemporary fiction and poetry for the genre for the past few years now, only like 3 or 4 years, but I'm just having a blast with it. Most of my background is actually very mainstream literary. Mm-hmm. I have an MFA from a brick and mortar MFA program that doesn't really specialize in speculative. Mm-hmm. And my bachelor's is also in English from a brick and mortar, you know, mm-hmm, university. Mm-hmm. That is a generic English degree. So while I've wildly read a lot of these more mainstream poets and fiction writers that, for example, Peter Straub mentioned in the last Locust roundtable, the speculative poets that I've discovered in the past 3 or 4 years feel like my tribe. It feels like, oh my gosh, I've been looking for you guys for like all my life, and I found you, and please keep writing more so that you can inspire me to write. And also I've discovered going to cons and stuff and just meeting various poets online as mm-hmm. well through their published work, that there's a real sense of warmth and community mm-hmm. Among the speculative poets, that they all support each other, they all know each other, they all publish each other, and they even write poems for each other, which I think is an amazing and awesome and magical tradition. We don't really do that right now in our contemporary times. I mean, though I do know that it is something that the Chinese did like over 1,000 years ago during the Tang Dynasty, you know, which was considered the Renaissance of Chinese poetry. But nowadays, you know, like the emails and even the Twitter and Facebook mm-hmm. that we have, I mean, they could be poetry, but more often than, you know, they have the brevity of poetry, but more often than not, they're not quite poetic. So it's just a wonderful thing to see these conversations and to see these poems being dedicated mm-hmm. to other poets that we know. So yeah, I'm just very delighted and very happy to be a part of this community.
I have to admit that when I was putting out invitations to write blog posts for this series, I was amazed that almost everyone I contacted would tell me, oh yes, I'd be happy to if I have the time, and oh, by the way, have you asked these 10 other people? It made it really easy to get a broad array of voices, at least I hope so.
I'm very glad. We're a friendly group, and hopefully we're a friendly group. And some of us are kind of have formed a community. I wouldn't say that it's our community is the only speculative community, because it's definitely speculative poetry community, because there's definitely more than one group, but our group is I would say mythic inspired, although we all write different things, and some of us are not mythic poets, but I think the core of our group, to which Emily and I belong, are rooted, I think, in the mythic tradition. What do you think, Emily?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we resonate and feed off of kind of mm-hmm. types that mythologies give us and provide right. for us, you know, and also, you know, kind of reinterpreting the mythologies, I think, is something that we love to mm-hmm. do. You know,
yeah, but let it not seem like we only write folklore and mythic, because we definitely do not. For example, Sophia Sumter, whom I mentioned earlier, wrote this heartbreaking, amazing science poem, "Girl Hours," which we published, Shveta and I, in Stone Telling 6, which was just terrific. It was nominated for the Riesling, and hopefully something will happen with it, because I just love this poem so much. Kat Valente has been lately experimenting with genres. She wrote cowboy punk. She wrote something about mecha girls, which is some science fiction, and some really interesting things. That Kat is forever experimenting, and it's just a delightful to read her poems. Always something new in them, but yeah, I would say that the core of our endeavor is rooted in mythic.
yeah, not only just the mythic, but also in the love of language.
Yes.
You know, I feel like, I mean, one criticism that the science fiction fantasy genre has in general from mainstream folk is that perhaps the language is subpar, you know, and but I think with poetry, and if you are a poet, you are just fascinated with language and fascinated with, you know, even punctuation and line breaks.
I'm laughing because I'm an editor.
Yeah,
I have people argue with over every single comma that I take in, take out, put in. I stopped doing this. I'm no longer shifting commas in people's thoughts.
Yeah, I went to this poetry and music symposium recently at St. Mary's, which is one of my alma mater, and they were explaining kind of the relationship between text and the music that the text is set to, and I kind of advocated for the poets because I said, you know, we have a tendency to be very OCD, for lack of a better phrase, about how our poetry looks on the page and sounds and, you know, where the pauses are and where the line breaks are. I mean, if you, mm-hmm. you know, we have such a tiny little canvas to work with that it, you know, we have to be very, like, controlling of it, you know, or it's possible to be controlling, I guess, is really what it is. And because it's other than you, versus if you were writing a novel or a short story where, you know, the canvas is so vast, you can't hold it all in your head. But a poem you can hold in your head, a poem you can kind of hold mm-hmm. and memorize and recite from memory very easily. And so I think, you know, it gives you that space to really look at how each word is used and if it has layers, and to look at where the line breaks are and to see what the user experience would be. And so I'm going to stop geeking out about the craft of poetry, but I really think that there is this love of language that mm-hmm. the speculative poets have that may not necessarily be something that a lot of the speculative fiction writers who don't write poetry have.
I definitely would say that among our group, the attention to language is very important, and we all come from such different traditions because we're all so different, and we're quite diverse. So we lean and draw from our own traditions, our own cultures, which place different emphasis on what it means for a poem to be a poem,
yeah.
what makes a good poetic language, what makes a good metaphor, the imagery that pops up. And so each of us has very distinct language. So the fact that we're so diverse and so distinct from each other, I think contributes, because as Emily said earlier, we inspire each other and learn from each other, but also kind of it helps to have this contrast to realize, wow, this is what really makes my voice versus Amal's or Emily's or Sonia's. And part of it is imagery. I think that imagery is something that I would like to see more discussion of within poetry in general, and speculative poetry in particular. What makes for successful imagery? And how much this imagery relies on the poet's background, traditions, but even things like age and sexual orientation and gender and all kinds of things that play into what imagery is successful and what imagery is detailed. What I see a lot of times in Stonetelling Slush is poetry that has strong ideas and maybe even a strong voice, but it's very lean on the imagery side. And that, for me, is much more problematic as an editor, of course. I'm not saying that my choices are universal, right? Because they're not. But I really love to see strong imagery, strong and unusual imagery, or imagery that really resonates emotionally. And that is much harder to find than just competent language or even beautiful language. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So a lot of times I'm reading poetry, and I'm reading poetry for stone telling, and I'm saying to myself, well, this is competent. I really like the idea. I like what the poem is saying, but it leaves me wanting for something to hang on to, for something for my imagination to take flight. And which is why I love the work of poets in stone telling, which I have featured a lot of times, have strong and unusual or strong and very emotionally potent imagery that just grabs you and doesn't let you go. And it's not generic because the poets are so different from each other. Many of them come from different traditions. Some of them are immigrants. Some of them are second, third generation immigrants. Some of them come from different cultures within the United States, outside of the United States. Many of them are folklorists. So this is interesting to me because people who read stuff that is not generally accessible mm-hmm. end up with an inventory of metaphor and idea. And I think this is relevant not just for poetry, but for all fiction. Speculative fiction in particular, those poets who are folklorists and or they're studying a culture that is not mainstream American culture, and in any capacity, as literary scholars, as historians, they end up with just this amazing inventory to draw from that is not necessarily derivative from the cultures they're studying, but just something clicks in their head and results in some unusual and captivating pieces that are just incredible. And I think this is a part of the growth of poetry that's happening, although I cannot be sure, but I think just a lot of people emerge into a scene who are either they're academics or they're studying something, and not academics in the usual, like, oh, those academics in every tower don't know what they're doing, but the kind of people who come from different corners of academia. There are scientists, there are people who are historians, people who are folklorists, people who are dealing with law, people who are dealing with all kinds of disciplines that are not immediately, okay, this is going to lead you to poetry, you know, down the poetry path. No. Those people just have kind of a very deep knowledge about some topics that have not been commonly associated with poetry. And then they find each other mm-hmm. and they tell each other, oh, wow, this is really cool. So can you tell me more about it? And then poems happen. And I think this is a kind of a very fertile ground right now for those people to find each other and to be inspired by each other.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and especially because Goblin Fruit and Stone Telling are both online. It's very
yes.
and can easily access. You can easily read these poems, and therefore find the poets whose aesthetics resonate with you more. And I also really think that. I mean, I think Rose touched on a very key ingredient for a lot of the poets that we love, which is that multicultural mm-hmm. background that they mm-hmm. have, and not only multicultural but often bilingual. Or right. multilingual, because in languages, and I'm going to go back to language with the poetry, which is the fact that if you know more than one language, and if you're fluent in more than one language, you actually understand that there are more than one ways to say something. Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of duh moment. But also, I think, something that we don't really think about a lot, that there are certain phrases, certain words in one language that don't exist. The concepts don't exist in another. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that when you are bilingual and or grow up bilingual. I actually am not bilingual. I consider myself 1.5 lingual. Which is, Mandarin was my first language, but English is my predominant language.
Emily. It's called yes. heritage speaker. You're a heritage speaker.
Oh, thank you. Uh-huh. I have a term now. This is yes. great.
Sorry. My linguist hat is on for a moment. I'm taking it off.
No, I love the linguist hat. This is awesome. But yeah, I feel like that if you're a poet and you're trying to express something that, you know, and if you have more than one culture to use... and more than one language to use, even. I mean, when I was in undergrad, I really loved the works of Derek Walcott. He's a Caribbean poet who often just fearlessly wrote in the three languages that he understood, which were... Yeah, and it was awesome and amazing, and no one else could really get the entire context unless you understood all three languages, which was a very small population of the world at the time, and probably still is right now. But, you know, for just the English-speaking part of it, it was just this amazing, awesome experience. And also, on a fiction side, Juno Diaz does some of that, too, which I really love, just the morphing of languages together. And I also think with poetry, I mean, Amal's done that too, a little bit, and
I think we've all done this. I mean,
yeah, Shweta's done it. Yeah, everyone
Shweta's been doing some very interesting things with it. I have want to draw attention to how much this depends on the editorial outlook. And kind of a normalizing of this multiculturalism that is happening in our corner of the speculative poetry field right now. Because I think with Amal and Jess editing Goblin Fruit, they, I think, did it first because of Amal and her specific background that prompted her to be interested in intersections of cultures and multiculturalism and multilingualism, and as a team they have been very open to this. And then, of course, I am a multilingual. I don't know even how to count how many languages, but at least a trilingual. And Shweta is in a very similar situation to mine, but from a completely different inventory of languages. So we two are very, and we're both linguists. She's a cognitive scientist. I'm a sociolinguist, and so we're very keenly aware of just not just the cultures, but the languages that go into every poet's work, and how much really you cannot preserve your tradition. You cannot preserve your language. You can maybe preserve your tradition, but you cannot preserve your language per se the moment you switch to English, because you cannot do the things that I would do in Russian or the things that I would do in Hebrew. I could not do in English because of the word order, because of the morphology, because of all of those things that make a successful poem in Russian just don't fly in English. So there's this process of translation that's also a process of becoming a bilingual and also adopting your whatever it is language into the English matrix, so that then it will be at least partially accessible to the reader who is not used to Juno Diaz or Derek Walcott like poetry, who is used more to things about starships and dragons exploding all over the place, and not very used to thinking about how cultures jam together. Because I think that in mainstream poetry we have this much more, and it's been normalized, and it's been, you know, it's been something on the forefront of literary poetry. There has been all those voices of poets from English-speaking diasporas, from the Caribbean, from South America, from various subcultures within North America, etc., 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 etc. Just an endless list of people who are very diverse. In speculative poetry, I think we're now doing it, and I think it's what's fresh about it right now, because the moment the editorial teams, the moment there was more than one editorial team, right? So Goblin Fruit and then Stone Telling, thinking intensely about what it makes to speak in multiple languages and how does it also limit us, because it does. Because it's not true to say, okay, now we have those multilingual poets or multicultural poets, they're just going to make, you know, this amazing poetry in English. No, it's a very painful process, because a part of this process, as I see it, is also an erasure of certain parts of your native culture and native language identity in order to be accessible to the English reader. And everybody does this, including Derek Walcott. I mean, you cannot do a multilingual piece without erasing parts of it and making it more accessible to your target audience, which is an English audience. the English-speaking audience, whatever English it is, right? So, but the moment we have those multiple editorial teams grappling with this, understanding that this is an issue, that we're struggling with language, we're struggling with cultures, we're struggling with what makes a fantasy or a science fiction piece that is not just Western but is multicultural, that creates some very interesting dialogue. And I've been noticing it in Stonetelling. Our first issue was called Silence to Speech, because especially because of those issues that I've just outlined, that I felt, I was editing the first issue alone, but I felt that what gets falls between the cracks is exactly this multiplicity of voices that might be speculative, might be literary, there are words in some languages that are not really there. What are we going to do with all this? So in the first issue of Stonetelling, I looked for those pieces. So Shveta's poem was bilingual, or at least incorporated some elements. Pure's poem was bilingual in ASL, which is amazing.
That was awesome. That broke my brain. Whoa. Like when I read
that, that was just wow. That was just wow. And he comes, you know, his background is very interesting also, because and really I should not spoil the poem because it's such a powerful poem, and I cannot spoil the poem for you, but it's a video recording. Part of it is in speech and part of it is in ASL, and it's just heartbreaking and tremendous. And it was his first published poem as well, which is something I'm very proud of, publishing all those first poems. But I really think that the synergy, oh god, I hate this word.
It's such a corporate word.
It is such a corporate word. I'm sorry for using it. But just this some topics you don't know they're there before people bring them to your attention. Do you know what I mean? Like, and suddenly it's like something you've been looking for a very long time, but you couldn't put it into words. But then somebody puts it into words, and oh my god, I have to talk about this, right? I have to write something about this. So this is what I've been seeing. This is what I've been seeing in my corner of the field, that people are really struggling with those ideas, what it takes to create a successful poem that will speak from the heart and would also tell some truths that are kind of painful sometimes, especially for people who are not monocultural or monolingual, but also for people who are monocultural and monolingual. I mean, there's no problem with being monolingual. Right? So I don't know.
Well, I also think, like, when you are struggling for identity, for example, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you are, you know, it is... and you are kind of trying to put together all the pieces that of your background that you come from, but that they are not necessarily defining who you are as an entire person. Mm-hmm. I think when you do kind of struggle, I think poetry is an excellent outlet for it. I think that, you know, when it's an excellent venue for it, because you can express yourself so freely on the page or on the printed screen with just mm-hmm. simple text, and you can arrange the text any way you want, which I think is wonderful. There's that visual component of poetry that lends itself to also the sounds of it and the rhythms. And I really love what Stonetelling is doing, because I do feel like they are encouraging underrepresented voices to just emerge and say very, very proudly, this is coming from me.
Right. We try. We'd love to see much more, and I just want to emphasize that we're welcoming to everyone, and let it not be said that we're you know, that we're only looking for certain things and certain voices. We're not. For me personally, diversity means people of every kind. coming from everywhere. And this includes a lot of people who have always been around and are very powerful poets in their own right. I've published some people who have been in the field much longer than I've been in the field. So Mike Allen is an example. Samantha Henderson is another example. Both have been very inspirational to me. And I published some tremendous work by both of them. So for me, encouraging new voices mostly means for me seeking people out when I see them and asking them to send me stuff to consider. And if I like what they're doing in other magazines, I would shamelessly email people and ask them, well, I like this piece. And you know what? How rarely do people just tell each other, I really liked that poem. I really liked that short story. And I think we should probably do it more, because a lot of times we really like something, but then we just pass by. Mm-hmm. And the kind of, you know, it kind of doesn't matter when we're talking about novels, because novels, I think, are mostly well covered, especially if they're traditionally published. But with poems, they're so small and they're so, in a way, fleeting, that it really helps the poet to know that his or her work touched someone and was meaningful. So I email, I shamelessly email, you know, and I invite people, I say, you know, why won't you submit? And there's also a lot of spillover. So people who submit to Stonetelling usually also like what Mythic Delirium is doing, usually also like what Strange Horizons is doing, usually also like what Goblin Fruit is doing. So there's a lot of kind of rotation happening lately that I think is very positive, because it gives the poet a feeling that they can write whatever they want and have a decent hope of publication, even with pieces that are difficult. And I'm not talking about pieces that still need work, that obviously nothing will help, but but pieces that are significant and important for the poet. Right now in the field, I think the poets can feel that they have a chance of placing their work, which is a good feeling to have. We're not there with chapbooks, though.
With chapbooks?
We need more chapbook.
We do need more chapbooks. Well, I was, like, in addition to Sonia's chapbook, which I think is stunning, I have yet to read it, but I'm very excited to read it. Amal's Honey Monk, which was inspired by different flavors of honey, like over almost 30 flavors of honey, and each story and or poem that was inspired by the taste is just an astonishing, awesome little gem. And I think more gems need to be collected and bound into collections to be published for people. And actually, Rose, aren't you doing a really great project for WisCon? Do you want to talk about it?
Well, I'm doing actually two things for WisCon. One is The Moment of Change, which is not the chapbook, it's an anthology, and it's the first ever anthology of speculative feminist poetry. And I just the way this happened is just I was editing Stonetelling, and I wanted to learn about people who were doing feminist speculative poetry in the field. And the first thing that occurred to me, surely Aqueduct has published an anthology. And I went and I didn't find anything, not just in Aqueduct, but anywhere. So then the random yet wonderful thought occurred to me, I can do it. So I pitched it to Timmy, and she took it on, and then I started soliciting things, and I had an open period, and it's just a great collection. I'm in love with this collection. It's pretty big, and it has all kinds of people in it, and my agenda, which is always my agenda, is to bring together people who are different, who are established and emerging, who are people of color, who are straight and queer, who are who are cisgendered or non-binary identified, all kinds of people from all kinds of traditions. And I found them. I found them, and I read a lot of wonderful poetry, and I'm publishing. This collection opens with Ursula Le Guin, and it ends up with Niecy Shawl, which I think is just oddly and wonderfully appropriate. And it has poetry by Emily Zhang, somebody I know, as well as by many other people. It has poetry by Shweta, by Lisa Bradley, who is a poet I really, really think is wonderful, by Amal, by Theodora Goss, Elisa Victoria, who's just a wonderful poet from the Philippines. Just many, many great people that I love featuring in this collection. So it's coming out, Wisconsin, featuring a cover with a painting by Terry Weinling, which again I think is just strangely and wonderfully appropriate. And Terry very generously allowed us to use this painting as a cover.
And gorgeous cover, yeah.
Yeah, I love this cover. So another thing that I'm hoping to finish for WISCON, although I'm not sure I'm going to finish it for WISCON because this is my first foray into traditional publishing, and it's harder than it looks. Much harder than it looks. By traditional, I mean not big press, but just a book. Something with pages rather than pixels. And I'm putting together an anthology of queer and gender-fluid poetry from Stonetelling issues 1-7. And featuring queer voices has been something of a thing for me. And each, I think, each of the issues of Stonetelling had some queer material. And in the beginning, I was really looking hard for it, and I was frustrated I'm not finding it. So I decided that I was going to do a queer issue. So as I kept talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, I felt that people were writing more and more queer pieces, which made me very happy. So so by the time of the queer issue, there's been quite a bit of wonderful queer poetry. And of course, some people were always writing it. Sonia has been always writing. Janelle Ferreira, who's just wonderful, also has been writing it. Kat has been writing it. But then I got to feature all of those people and more. And so I'm putting together a chapbook that has quite a few queer poems that are terrific, and it's going to be the first title of my press. This sounds really pompous. It's ridiculous. It's not. It's really tiny. It's called Stonebird Press because I have a thing for birds, as those who know me know. And this is going to be the first title, and Jennifer Smith, who is my fearless assistant editor and copy editor, is toiling in this impossible project of what's possible. It's just very new for us, of putting words into a book form, which is both exciting and hard. And at the same time, I'm also working on my own chapbook of my own poems. So I don't know if you guys want to talk about that. I don't know how exciting it is.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, so
here's a question I have, actually, that I'm also starting to collect my poems. I mean, I write them kind of just as they come to me, so there's no usual direction unless there's an obvious theme. But how do you know, Rose, when you have enough poems to collect, and how do you sort them in a collection? And also, this is a good question as an anthologist, how do you figure out like order and how do you just put it all together? It's just a question that I have for you.
Those are two different questions.
Okay, two different questions that I have.
Two different questions. Those are great questions. I love those questions. But they're let me see if I can answer them one by one. Okay. I'm new to the field, so everything I say, please take it with a huge, like, gigantic grain of salt, because I am not a maven on this topic, but back in 2010, I think, 2010, yes, I was approached by someone, I'm not going to name names, and they suggested that I publish a chapbook, a collection, really not the chapbook, of my poetry with their press. The press, and I've been putting it together, and I decided, well, I write about birds a lot, so it's going to be kind of loosely about birds. And it wasn't, of course, then when I was starting to look through my poems, most of them were not about birds. It was just, I was feeling that it was kind of disjointed and didn't have a direction. So luckily for me, although I didn't like what happened at the time, but really luckily for me, the press folded, and so this could not never materialize. So my next project, which is my current chapbook, is much more cohesive. It's something I wanted to do for a long time. It's a chapbook about shape changers, and many of them are queer, because this is a theme that I feel the need to explore for myself. And it started when I wrote some longer pieces that had shape change and were queer. And then this idea came to me, so I kind of made a conscious decision to keep writing those poems. And so I wrote a large one, an epic length piece that kind of started it all, that didn't have quite that much shape change, but it was queer, and it's called In the Third Cycle, and it was published at Strange Horizons, and it won the Rana competition and the Strange Horizons readers poll. It's my favorite poem. Okay,
and it's an epic, amazing, blow your mind poem. Everyone needs to read it.
I cannot speak about it with a straight face, because this is my best work, and it kind of emerged for me over when I was grading. Speaking of avoidance, I was grading, and suddenly out of this anguish of this grading, those piles of things that made some of them made more sense than others, to put it mildly. Suddenly I was writing about this those three epic personages, and crying, and God knows, it completely overwhelmed me. But then I kind of decided to make it a conscious direction in my chapbook, and starting with late 2011, I made a decision that if I have a chance, I will write about shape change, just poems about shape change. And then the auction for Terry Wendling came up, and I volunteered to write a poem, and I put a minimum bid of, I don't even remember, I think $10, to write a poem about metamorphosis, about shape change, because that's one of Terry's themes as well. It's a very mythic theme. And if people would bid up to a certain amount, I would write three poems, and if people would bid up to a certain amount, I would create art to go with it. And it kind of was blown out of proportion. People kept bidding. I was hiding in the corner. I didn't understand why they kept bidding. And they bid it up to...
Because they want more awesome.
They bid it up to where I was committed to writing three poems with at least three original pieces of art to go with it, and binding it into an artist book. So I ended up writing one epic poem that had three acts and an epilogue, and had eight block prints originally created, and was leather bound, and was kind of I also was kind of running with it. And when I finished the poem, that was finished in January, and it's going to come up in Strange Horizons. I sold it then to Strange Horizons. I knew that this will make a chapbook. So I'm doing it. I'm two poems short of my goal. My fear of how long it will be, my fear is that I'm just becoming repetitive with all those shape change poems, but people are not complaining so far, so maybe I'm still fine. I like this chapbook much more than the idea of just putting a collection together, because it feels cohesive to me, and it feels like something that has a unifying theme that people will just go through and get maybe kind of like a feeling from. Because for me, this chapbook is kind of a little world, kind of like a mouse honey month, where each taste of honey is its own thing, but together they create a world. So I really like that idea, which is not to say that there can't be chapbooks that are that don't have an overarching theme and are successful. I've seen many of those. but I personally enjoy working with an overarching theme. Now, how do I order them? When I was putting together... Actually, let me talk about the My CB Hall, Sonia's chapbook. Sonia asked me if I could help her order the poems. And I did. And I did it while... I love Sonia's work. I adore her work. And I'm also Jewish. And
I'm not Jewish, but I still love her work.
I don't love her work because it's Jewish. I love it because it's awesome.
Yeah.
the many, many references to Jewish folklore and kind of mysticism are of great value to me because of who I am. And, but this is not to say it doesn't have this impact on others. Obviously, it does. So Sonia asked me to see if I could order them. And I printed them out, and I was taking my son to horse therapy. My son has autism, so I take him to all kinds of therapies. And he was riding a horse, and I was sitting there on the edge of the barn with all those golem and Dybbuk poems. And the way I went about it was by last and first lines. And I just I went and I saw which last lines organically led to first lines. And with Sonia's poetry, because it's so cohesive, and you won't be able to do it with every single poet. But with Sonia, I was able to do it because... her poetry is a corpus. Her poetry does not exist in a kind of disjointed space, but it all speaks to each other, and it's a very complex, multi-referential, multi-layered dialogue with books and traditions and other poets. Sonia is very layered, but her poems are also... they speak to each other, not just to the world outside them. So I looked at the last and the first lines, and that's how I ordered them. And I actually think some people remarked about this. I think Amal, in her review for Cascadia's Subduction Zone, remarked, if I'm not mistaken, about the first and the last lines. She caught me in my trick. I don't know if I'll be able to do this for other anthologies and collections that I put together, but we'll see. I'll try this again. For the moment of change, what happened is that I knew, and this always happens to me, I knew the first and the last piece. And this is very important, I think, as a trick to ordering. With stone telling too, I always, the first thing I figure out is the first and the last piece. And then I have a secret weapon. It's called Shveta Narayan.
How can you not so secret weapons? You guys are known to collaborate quite a bit.
Yes. And she's wonderful because she prints them out and she spreads them on the floor. And then she comes up with orders, or sometimes I come up with an order, but she's just very good about it. But I usually figure the first and the last piece. With the moment of change, I knew that I wanted to start with Ursula Le Guin and end with Nisi Shoal, and I knew the specific pieces. And then the rest was a headache, and Shveta really helped me there, because when you're ordering 70-something poems, it's quite different from ordering 18-or-something poems. So she really helped, and we kept arguing about and arguing in a good way, not in like an argument type of way, but we kept arguing which poems A, spoke to each other, B, thematically led to each other, C, did not overwhelm each other, and were not too similar and not too dissimilar. It's kind of like putting together a puzzle. In fact, we had a lot of fun with that, but it took a lot of time. So for my own chapbook, I know the first and the last piece, but I don't know what's inside, so we'll see. I mean, I know the poems, I don't know the order, so we'll see. Does that answer the questions?
Yeah.
I don't even remember. Yeah, but I'm new to this, but I'm having a lot of fun, and I think that part of it that I think is great about our corner of the speculative poetry field is the joy. It's just the joy and the creativity of trying things and being honest and being inspired and being fiery or not fiery. Some of us are not as fiery.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is so true, is that if we are driven by joy and or just driven by honest emotion, mm-hmm. the poem yes. sometimes just is a gift, you know? I actually know that Shweta sometimes, you know, when she takes a shower and then she steps out of the shower, a poem just immediately comes to her and she has to write it down, and no one can talk because she has to write it down. Otherwise the poem will, you know, escape as the real world of outside the shower intrudes. So yeah, I do think that poems are gifts often. I mean, you also have to work at them when you revise sometimes, but mm-hmm. but overall they're just really wonderful gifts.
I agree. I get my poems a lot during walks. I take walks and a poem. And I come from a very strong oral tradition, so I do not carry any means of writing things down with me ever. I mean, even if I do, sometimes I do, and I can't be bothered to write things down because in my mind, and I operate differently from almost everyone else that I know, but in my mind, if I'm not remembering something, then my mind is telling me it's not worth remembering. And I know with poems, I used to be a compulsive destroyer of my own work. This was previously. I don't do this anymore. But I would, in a fit of artistic rage, I don't even know, I would erase something. And then I would realize, wow, I remember it verbatim. So I could recreate it. And then I would know that a poem is worth keeping and working on because it would be in my head. Nowadays, I'm not deleting my own work. Mostly, I'm not deleting my own work. But this is still a very valid criterion for me, not just with my poems, but with everybody else's, because, as I said, they come from an oral tradition. Russians love memorizing poetry. This is a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I grew up memorizing poetry. I love memorizing poetry, and I kind of do it already. So when I'm reading for stone telling, I sometimes remember lines of poems, and the poems which lines I remember are the poems that I want to look at again and again until I'm convinced that I'm ready to buy. And poems that are competent and wonderful but do not stick in my mind are more doubtful for me. So yeah.
Yeah, but, makes a ton of sense. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, because, I mean, the first poem that I ever memorized was in Chinese and Mandarin. Yeah. And so I do agree that the oral tradition of reciting poetry mm-hmm. is something that actually I think America as a culture is starting to revive. I mean, mm-hmm. the past 15 to 20 years, there was the slam poetry movement, which I think is fascinating. Like, it's so different. I mean, it's really raw and emotional, and it's performative art in so many ways, and I think poetry readings are skewing more and more towards that. Like, for a while I went to a bunch of poetry readings as an undergraduate and kind of found them deathly boring. Like, one of my favorite poets, I hate to out myself, but I will, one of my favorite poets is Louise Gluck. And she was one of the first poetry readings, like official poetry readings I'd ever gone to as an undergraduate. And I was so excited mm-hmm. to hear her speak. And mm-hmm. then was very disappointed at her almost monotone delivery. And mm-hmm. I think that that's probably an aesthetic choice. I think perhaps mm-hmm. there is that population of poet who believe that when you're reading a poem that the words should just speak for themselves and you shouldn't really interpret more than what the words are, which I think is a valid point as well. But for as a listener, and especially as a undergraduate student, it was mm-hmm. not the most entertaining experience. But on the other side of the spectrum, I listened to Adrienne Rich speak, and uh-huh. oh my gosh, that is an amazing, the late Adrienne Rich. She is just, you know, she was also a feminist and majorly into all this activism. And to hear her speak, she was maybe 80 years old when I heard her for the first time. And she had this little red walker. It was bright, cherry red. It was awesome. And she was trying to get up the stage, and she was moving slowly and kind of, to be honest, teetering a little bit on her legs. And I was really afraid because I knew she was in her 80s, and I was afraid that, you know, I don't know what to expect. But the moment she stood on that podium and spoke, those words just... they rushed. They were like a physical force rushing through you. And I think that is the tradition. That is when poetry is the most powerful, is when it just rushes through you. Another reading that I went to was at, I want to say, World Fantasy last year. Mm-hmm. The poetry reading. Oh, Rose did a really amazing open mic.
Oh, thank you. I did this open mic. This was my first poetry reading in the world.
It was, goodness. Awesome, because I didn't know what to expect. Again, you never know what to expect when it's the first open mic for poetry year that you go to. And so, you know, I invited a bunch of my Clarion friends who had other commitments, so they were not poets anyway, so it was fine. But so I kind of stayed with my poet friends, and it was one of the most... it was a highlight for my World Fantasy. I'll just say it right now. It was a wonderful experience just to listen to these people recite their words that came from them. And Carolyn Cooney did this amazing epic recitation.
So what happened there is I was organizing, and I've never been to a con. I mean, I've been to a con in 2001 as a fan, and that was it. And then suddenly I'm in on the scene, I'm an editor, all those things that sound really, really dramatic, but really are not. and then suddenly I'm organizing this reading. And Sam Henderson told me, well, we're going to present the Reisling, can we present the Reisling Award in the long poetry category to Claire Cooney, who won with her poem The Seeking Second Bride. And I say, sure, why not? And Sam says, well, how do you want to go about it? Because nobody will want to go after Claire. And I'm like, why? And Sam says, well... Claire is this theater person. You've never met Claire, and I've never met anyone at that point, because I'm going to Wisconsin this year, but travel is an issue for me for many reasons. But I was going to World Fantasy, and no, I've never met Claire. And so she says, no, Claire is a theater person. She has this amazing presence, and trust me, nobody's going to go after her. And I said, put her first. So, okay, we put her first. And then I went to Shveta, because... who do I go to when things like this occur? Go to Shveta and I say, listen, I'm gonna go second.
And she did, and Shveta was awesome.
She
of
was
course.
Terrific. And Claire, course, was... Claire was just this, she did this whole performance. It was lasted 10 minutes.
And it was epic.
It was, oh my God, she performed. She's like, people were astounded, and everybody, as the poem ended, everybody was sitting there and saying to themselves, I'm not going to go after this person. Not going to do it. It's not going to happen. And then, of course, Shveta is a completely different poet with a very distinct voice, with a very distinct and wonderful presence, which is quite somber, I would say, whereas Claire was just flamboyant. Shveta is, you know, has this very intense energy, but it's very different from Claire's. So, in a way,
it was a wonderful cleansing, you know.
Yes,
it's a wonderful contrast to, and I think it was the right way to do it, Rose.
Yeah, and then that's why it worked, because I knew those pieces that they were going to read. So, speaking of ordering, feeling like I'm ordering, and then after Shveta read, I think people felt, okay, this is going to be, and again, the sword repeats for me, but this is going to be a multiplicity of voices, and this is not going to be a competition, right? Where Claire read this amazing poem, so now I'm going to sit and be ashamed to read mine or be afraid to read mine. No, people realize that it's going to be diverse and it's going to be vibrant, but it's also going to be, each person will get to do their own thing.
Really amazing poets there. Mari Ness.
Yeah,
was there.
Mari Ness went
through. Oh,
third.
She did. Great. And Naaman was there.
No, Naaman.
He was there because I forced him to be there, because he read Stone Telling published one of my poems, one of my Chinese mythological poems about the Monkey King, and it's a first person voice, therefore I could not in good faith be the Monkey King, so I made Naaman do it in the original recording, and he was also at World Fantasy, so then I kind of, you know, forced him to come and read not only my poem, but some of his own poetry, too, and he's a fantastic poet as well.
Naaman read the piece titled The Faggot Dinosaur. People kept blogging about this. Oh, and this amazing poet read the poem entitled The Faggot Dinosaur. And, oh my god, it was a great poem. Unfortunately, he already sold it somewhere else. So I would have bought it.
To an anthology called Faggot Dinosaur, which was kind of the gimmick for that anthology. And also people who showed up at the poetry reading, Jessica Wick, one of the awesome co-editors of Goblin Fruit, and Caitlin Paxton, who is now also on staff with Goblin Fruit. And it was just really cool to see all these amazing people. Sam was there, right? Sam was there?
Yeah, Sam was right? there. Sharon yes. Shin was there.
Sharon Shin showed up! Oh my
yes,
god!
Yes, yes. There was all kinds. It was really terrific. People we knew, people we didn't know, people who were emerging, people who were old-timers. It was just terrific. It was great. We had a lot of fun. Oh, and Neil Graham, right? Am I mispronouncing her name horribly? She's just a terrific poet that writes beautifully about nature, and some of the most amazing works that are very evocative of just nature and her specific places where she lives, and this was a great reading. I'm actually doing a reading at WISCON, which is going to be the Moment of Change reading for feminist speculative poetry. So we'll see if we'll have this energy. I very much hope so.
I definitely think there will be. And I also think that, you know, sharing your poetry through the spoken word is also an amazing experience. And that's why I really love the internet and having all these magazines online, because Stonetelling started, I think, with providing auditory experiences of the poems as well as visual experiences of the poems.
Actually, we were not the first. The first were Goblin Fruit.
Oh, but okay.
What happened with Goblin Fruit is that they...
Sorry, I apologize.
No. It's they inspired me, but they put the recording alongside on the table of contents. So when you click through, you could not hear the recording. If you click through to the poem, you had to go back to the table of contents and click, which is a system that worked for them, but for me, I decided that I had to put the link with the poem itself on the page, so the person who is reading the poem could also follow it, listen to it and follow it. And then the Goblin editors decided that they like it, and so now they also do this on the page with the software that I recommended. But we were Stonetelling, we're trying to do everything. We're trying to put art, it's photography that we find under Creative Commons license, and we're trying to do recordings and, if possible, video. Although we didn't have a lot of video, it's not something that people, for some reason, want to contribute. But we had a lot of art.
I would love to see more ASL poems, because that.
Well,
was
you
just...
need to talk to Pierre. You need to talk to Pierre. or find more ASL poems because wouldn't it be great if we had more ASL poems? Wouldn't it be great if we had more of everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that I really loved putting together is in Stonetelling 7, there is this epic poem that was written especially for this issue by Lisa Bradley, who is terrific. And I keep saying this about people only because they really are terrific. And she wrote a poem in 4,000 words about three brothers that marry three sisters, and I'm not going to spoiler it for you.
it's fantastic.
It's a fantastic. It's a horror poem. It's just astounding. It's she was writing it, and I know from talking to her later that she was afraid that she was writing it, and it's queer, of course, and before the queer issue, and she was afraid that I'm not going to accept it, and what was she going to do with it, which is a very valid, I think, fear for 4,000 word horror queer poem. But I bought it. It was terrific. And so then I did a casting call on my blog, and I said, well, who wants to volunteer to be those six voices? And within less than 24 hours, I had more than six people volunteer. I had a queue of people who wanted to be in this poem. And so we cast folks into their respective roles, and they recorded, and then we had it mixed. And we had it mixed by Sam Henderson's wonderful husband, Martin, who's done this work for us before. And it's 25 minutes, and it's recommended. So I love this type of thing where different genres and mediums mix together to create something new. Which brings me back to Emily, who is right now making some music. Is that right, Emily?
Oh, okay.
Well, hopefully that actually leads into what I consider sort of the traditional locus roundup. You know,
uh-oh,
we come to probably the end of a podcast. I like to give everyone a chance to talk about what they're doing right now and what people should be looking out for. And so, mm-hmm, Emily, talk about what you're doing. This sounds really exciting.
Oh, about the music?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry, it's just, you know, unusual to have people who are artists in so many different mediums, you know, media.
I was actually partially inspired, honestly, by Seanan McGuire, who is not only a fiction writer and a poet herself, but she also writes music. And I attended one of her concerts at one of her book signings, and I was just kind of blown away by just all the amazing awesomeness that you can amass at one event. And it really gave me the courage to just try to write my own music. I am not at all a popular musically trained person. I am classically trained in music as a pianist and as a singer. So I just did what I knew, which is choral music, because I've been singing choral music for a long, mm-hmm, long time now. And I'm writing art songs, and I'm finding poems and texts that inspire me, and kind of trying to set them to the music that I hear in my head, and having a wonderful time holding these workshops. I actually have set some of Rose's poetry. I've set one of Shweta's poems and some work by Amal as well. And I'm constantly reading this. It's actually a wonderful way for me to approach poetry, is from this, can I hear the music in my head kind of perspective. I'm constantly looking for stuff. I definitely plan to set some of Kat's work as well as Sonia's once I find the poem that actually sings to me and says, you must write me down as a song. And and also many, many other poets whose work I admire. It's funny. It's kind of like what Rose said about editing. It's like some poetry that you read, you really love, but if it doesn't sing to you, you can't interpret it, or you can't accept it into your own creative space because there's no entryway. So it's a similar kind of journey that I'm having, and it's wonderful. It's really actually creating music is really informing my creative process and writing as well, and because they are both mediums that require time in order for the person to consume it. And so it's been a really wonderful, creatively inspiring experience for me. And if you are a poet, I would love to know more about your work. But I'm constantly reading and scouring the magazines for new things. So I think that, you know, setting... giving a song to a contemporary poet is just one of the coolest things ever. It makes it of our time, and I'm very excited about it. So, sorry, that was a really lame...
No,
that was great. Well, I'm yet to hear any of those famous songs, so I'm looking forward to
it. You will!
I will, I want to. Okay.
And Rose, what should people be looking out for from you coming up, you know, in the space of the next few months?
Well, I think I already mentioned The Moment of Change, which is coming out in the end of May and will be out at WisCon. And the Queer Chapbook will be also hopefully out at WisCon, but if not, maybe a week later. up to that. Of my own work, I think I'm most excited about my poem Between the Mountain and the Moon, which I mentioned, that I wrote for Terry Wendling's fundraiser, and that will be coming up at Strange Horizons. So please look out for it.
Excellent. Well, with that, I'd like to thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you for having us. It was fun.
Thank you, Karen. This was awesome.
Excellent. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and hopefully, with any luck, we will talk to you both again.
Thank you.